From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. John Fairchild turned fashion designers into celebrities, coined the term Nouvelle Society, and invented the What's In, What's Out list. He's publisher of Women's Wear Daily, the fashion industry's influential trade journal. On today's Fresh Air, Fairchild takes us inside the fashion industry. Also, some advice on how to lead through respect, not intimidation, from Max Dupree. He's the former CEO of Herman Miller, the furniture company. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from Los Angeles rapper Ice-T. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Steel Magnolias, the new movie with an all-star cast, including Dolly Parton, Shirley MacLaine, and Olympia Dukakis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Seven children were killed today and more than 18 were injured when a glass wall blew in on a school cafeteria during a severe thunderstorm in Newburgh, New York. State police and survivors say they believe the school was hit by a tornado, but the National Weather Service says it cannot confirm that until investigators are sent to the scene. The storm system is the same one that moved through the South yesterday, spawning tornadoes that killed 17 people in Alabama. Six Jesuit priests were tortured and murdered today on a university campus in San Salvador. Witnesses say uniformed soldiers broke into the Central American University, shooting the priests and two university employees. The government and military today denied involvement in the killings, and the U.S. has asked for a full investigation. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has details.
Spokesman Margaret Tutwiler said there is no evidence to prove who was responsible for the murders.
We do not know who committed this barbarous act, which we condemn in the strongest possible terms. Our ambassador will be taking up this matter with President Cristiani today.
The U.S. ambassador to El Salvador, William Walker, said if high-level people connected to the government were responsible and not brought to justice, then it would be of serious concern for U.S. policy. Some congressmen are calling for the Salvadoran government and the rebels to seek a political settlement to the war. The State Department announced it will speed up the delivery of more weapons to the government. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
A new government is about to be formed in East Germany that gives unprecedented power to four minor non-communist parties. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from East Berlin.
The new government in East Germany will include 11 non-communist ministers out of a total of 27. They will go to four legal minor parties that have been under the control of the communists in the past, but are now exerting their independence. And in exchange for their continued cooperation in the government, the minor parties have persuaded the Communist Party to permit the rewriting of the nation's constitution. The constitution ensures that the Communist Party maintains a monopoly on political power. But the minor parties want that to end, and they want a national debate on what form of government should replace it. I'm Mike Schuster in East Berlin.
The House voted today for higher pay and ethics reform that would prevent Congress from giving itself future salary increases until after the next election. The raise amounts to a third of a representative's current salary. The language would also force Congress to vote on any raise, ending the current statute that permits lawmakers to let a presidentially recommended pay raise take effect without a vote. Three South Africans and two Americans were indicted today for allegedly conspiring to export $50 million worth of U.S. missile guidance equipment to South Africa through Israel. The five were charged as part of an ongoing Customs Service undercover operation. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 3 points to close the day at 2635.66. This is NPR News. Government scientists say today they've developed an experimental birth control vaccine that provides safe long-term contraception in mice and may one day be adaptable for human use. But according to Jurian Dean of the National Institute of Diabetes, the application to humans is more than a decade off. In the meantime, Dean said scientists' findings may prove useful in veterinary medicine. A California lawmaker was denied the right to receive communion in the Catholic Diocese of San Diego because of her public stand favoring rights for women to have an abortion. Lynn Weil of CalNet Public Radio has more.
Kille has been a Democratic assemblywoman in San Diego for 7 years. She's running for a state Senate seat against an anti-abortion Republican, also an assemblywoman. Kille believes the Catholic Diocese of San Diego timed its decision to the election scheduled for December 5th.
This is much more high-profile issue
this year than it's been in the past. It has no change in my position, but I think it's just more publicity about it and more press and so on.
The San Diego diocese is saying little about its action, and Kilei's opponent in the Senate race denies any part in it. Kilei says the issue is particularly crucial because the Supreme Court's Webster decision earlier this year gave individual state legislatures the power to determine abortion laws. California extends the fundamental right to privacy to include abortions. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Weil reporting.
More than 10,000 people took a walk on the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge today, 2 days before the span is scheduled to reopen for the first time since it was damaged in last month's earthquake. Governor George Duke Magian called the reopening an important step toward California's recovery from the devastating quake. The Senate confirmation hearing of Victor Stelo as chief of the nuclear weapons production hit an impasse today amid charges by a Republican member that Democrats were raising baseless allegations to kill the nomination. Armed Services Committee Chairman Sam Nunn says the panel will meet in closed session tomorrow to consider how to proceed. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Fairchild, is considered one of the most powerful and most feared people in the fashion world. Fairchild's grandfather founded Women's Wear Daily at the turn of the century. John Fairchild took it over from his father in 1967 and changed it from a trade journal into what Time magazine once described as a lively, gossipy, and bitchy newspaper of manners, trends, and scandal, a must-read for anyone in the fashion business and for members of the social set who want to know what's up and what's in. Fairchild has turned designers into celebrities, but he also has a reputation for going for the jugular in fashion reviews and fashion gossip. John Fairchild is the CEO of Fairchild Publications and vice president of Capital Cities Broadcasting. After his company merged with Capital Cities, he launched the fashion magazines W and M. Fairchild's new book about the fashion world is called Chic Savages. I asked him to compare the fashion world now to what it was like in the 60s when he took over Women's Wear Daily.
Well, the big change is that fashion has really become big, big business. I mean, when you consider you have a designer like Ralph Lauren who's doing something like $2.6 billion a year and a Calvin Klein who's doing close to $2 billion a year, that's where the big change. But the way it works hasn't changed, really. Because basically, new ideas in fashion, and there's nothing, I'm putting quotes around new, there really are no new ideas in fashion because it goes back to what we've seen before. But the ones who start so-called ideas, which everybody copies, come from Europe. And those ideas are basically starting in still high fashion, expensive clothes. And it's eventually watered down to all levels. It goes as far away as China. Like you can see a collar on a Saint Laurent dress copied in China. So basically the way it works has not changed one bit.
Why has fashion become more big business than it used to be?
Well, I suppose because they have developed a very clever device of licensing their names on everything. For example, Yves Saint Laurent, Japan, has his names on doormats. Pierre Cardin in Paris has his name on plumbing equipment. And they get a royalty on this, so you can imagine how far it's gone. I mean, Yves Saint Laurent has his name on cigarettes. So this is where the real money's coming in, and it's a lot of money.
Let's talk about how the fashion press has changed. How did you define Women's Wear Daily when you took it over differently from how your grandfather defined it when he started it back in, I think it was 1910?
Well, first, I've been very lucky to inherit something that was started by my grandfather, who actually started in Chicago selling information about textiles on a horse and buggy, and all the pricing information of cloth. That's how our business started, and now it's grown into a business of 1,200 people. And my father really built Women's Wear Daily into what it is today. My role, or our role, I should say, is, because we all work together as a team, several of us, when I came back in the early 50s, was to try to make something that which was more of a very staid, reliable, conservative business or trade paper into something that was exciting and everybody wanted to read.
You say that when you started reviewing fashion shows and sending out reporters to review them, you wanted them reviewed like movie reviews. What's the difference between the kind of review you were interested in of fashion collections and the kind of reviews that were being written when you started?
Well, when I started, we used to go to a fashion show, and we'd sit there and give endless descriptions of clothes. I mean, there's nothing more boring than watching a parade of clothes or endless words about written about clothes, whether the shirt, the collar is this way or that way. So what we did do was relate the fashion to people and to the designers themselves. The designers, for example, on 7th Avenue never came out of their... They were locked up in the back room. As a personality, they did not exist. And we were the first ones to really make the designer into, well, I'd call today, some of them are as famous as movie stars and rock stars. And we brought them out of the that back room where they were sketching away. But to answer your question specifically, it's very simple that we have a big responsibility, and so do the other fashion writers of the New York Times, that people read what we say before they put down thousands and thousands of dollars buying a designer's clothes. So when we look at it, whether we're right or wrong, we sometimes have a critical point of view, we all do, of who has a good collection versus the other person, or whose clothes are better than the others, and what are the trends. So obviously the stores and the people who buy clothes do look at that, then they make their own decisions.
It's a very insular world in a way, like most specialized worlds are. But I'm thinking that, you know, you cover the designers and their new lines, and those same designers also advertise in your magazine. I wonder what goes through your mind when you say something really negative about a new show, wondering if you'll be losing their advertising dollars when you do it. I know one of the things you're famous for in your magazines is printing very negative things, so I realize this hasn't held you back a lot, but I'm sure something you had to contend with.
I've got to go back to what the first important questions you asked me. How do we cover arrive at a conclusion about a show? Well, we talk to other people in the room. We talk to the people themselves who are going to buy the clothes that are there. We are influenced by what they say. We talk to other members of the press. You realize that when you see a show in Paris, there are sometimes 2,000 people under one tent from all over the world watching what's going on in fashion. You can imagine 2,000 people there. And in that room, maybe out of that 2,000, there might be 50 or 60 people who really will determine what is bought. And they are the opinion makers. And we try to seek some of them out. And when we're basically reporters, and that's the way I began, and I hope I'll end up being that, always a reporter. We go and look at something isolated. We aren't thinking about who's an advertiser and whose feelings we're going to hurt. We just have to report. That's our responsibility. And we have lost advertising. For example, in W, which is our consumer publication, we have done an in and out list, and we said a certain Swiss watch was out. We lost one of our biggest advertisers, plus all the other Swiss manufacturers of watches canceled too, because they all got together. So I don't say we're fearless. I say we have to all eat, but we are quite pure when it comes to writing about fashion collections or shows.
John Fairchild is my guest. He's the publisher of the magazines Women's Wear Daily and W, and the author of the new book Chic Savages, which is about the fashion world. You coined the term Nouvelle Society. Compare Nouvelle Society to the old guard.
Well, Nouvelle Society, you've got to think in terms of people. I think the Nouvelle Society really began way back in Palm Beach with the Kennedys, when the Kennedys were not very much accepted by that Palm Beach crowd, and they suddenly, when Jackie got into the White House, it became very stylish to go to the White House. She became very chic. She became a fashion plate. Everybody wanted to know what she was wearing, as the president said. They're more interested in her clothes than in anything he was doing or saying. And it was true there for a while. So it's nothing new about it. It just is a word. It's changed starting out from the conservative group who were never seen or heard from before, and they're suddenly coming out in the world and want to be photographed. It's interesting how people today, even who are not stage stars or even designers, society people, want to be photographed. They have the urge to be photographed. For example, business people like Donald Trump, his wife, Ivana Trump, they get so much publicity. Every time she buys a new dress, everybody rushes to photograph her. Every time she has her facelift, it makes front page news. It's a new world we're living in. I'm not one to criticize it, but it's part of the greed and the richness of the Reagan era. By the way, I think it's ending. It's coming to an end. We are now saying that We have watched what's going on, particularly in New York. These people are retreating into a more softer stance. We call it soft society.
What do you mean by soft society?
Well, they're quieter. They aren't wearing the jewels to the opera like they used to. They are waking up to the fact that, you know, in a city of like New York, and you know what it's like, people have to be, we have serious problems. And to get dressed up at night and to go out in a big stretch limousine, it's got to make anybody feel a little bit funny. I mean, you just don't feel right about it. I think that this group of Nouvelle Society are getting more conservative. They're getting quieter and they're softer.
How have the parties changed that you've covered and attended over the years?
Well, I don't go to too many parties myself because I don't have the energy after I work all day. I'd say they've gotten bigger, with more flowers, better food, more dresses, more jewels, more people. And all of these parties, it's become a charity party. They're all for charity. It has nothing to do with the people dress up for them, but the money eventually does end up and for a good cause. And I think that's fine. But we see that even these parties, people are getting tired of them, and they're retreating more into their homes and giving quiet parties.
You write that anyone with enough money and stamina can become an overnight sensation. Give me some examples with people who you feel, you know, have kind of bought or pushed their way into celebrityhood.
Well, I think if you take all of New York society, I didn't say they bought, but some of them do hire PR people to get their names in the paper. I suppose that's a form of buying your way to get attention. Some of them call up and say, well, we're giving a party, and would you like to come and photograph us at the party? I think the Trumps are a living example of that. Every time they turn around or move, there's something to do with PR. They're photographed every place. You see so many pictures of Donald Trump on the covers of magazines. Every time she does something at the plaza, we hear about it. It's all written about. I think that's a very good example of what's happened.
How much do you feel you play into that?
That's a good question. We have a tough time sometimes. They're exciting people. I mean, getting back to Trumps. She's an interesting woman to talk to, and we play into it. And when she calls up and said, well, would you like to come down to Atlantic City in my helicopter, when she was running the thing in Atlantic City, and see how I work and how I run the hotel? And we fall into it because we write about her, like everybody else. The thing is to find people who don't mix or don't want all this, who are interesting. There are a lot of people who are very interesting, but just don't want to have part of it. They still are some that are very quiet.
Do you find yourself ever having contempt for some of the people who are written about in your magazines? It seems to be a kind of world where there's just a lot of backbiting, a lot of cattiness, and I guess that's part of, you know, the, quote, fun of it all.
Well, I can't say it's fun in a way, but that's why the title of the book, Chic Savages, because it's sort of a tribal dance. They're in the jungle. Each one is trying to do something better than the other. They're very competitive society, just as the designers are very competitive, just as businessmen are very competitive. But individually, when you sit down and talk to them, you can't have contempt for them because they're nice people. You like them. It's when they all get together and they're herded into a restaurant like Le Cirque in New York on Park Avenue, and you see them performing, and you see them wanting to have the tables on the right, and then they throw a scene if they're stuck in the middle or on their left. Then you sort of think, I think it's not contempt. I think it's a bit silly. I mean, you know, there are other things that are more important in life. However, as a reporter, and I suppose I've been accused of being cynical and mean, it's great fun to write about it, and that's why I did my book.
John Fairchild is my guest. He's the publisher of the magazines Women's Wear Daily and W, and the author of the new book, Chic Savages, which is an inside look at life in the world of fashion. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
John Fairchild is my guest. We were just talking about fashion parties, celebrity parties, chic parties. And that brings to mind a word. I'm not sure if you coined this one or not. Walkers?
Yes, I did.
Define it for us.
Well, you know, when men work hard all day, and they have a very energetic wife who likes to go out wearing evening clothes and being dressed up, and she goes to the hairdresser and ready to go at night when he comes home, and they're tired, they have to have somebody to take them out. So a walker is nothing more than an escort. Some of these walkers are at lunch with these ladies. Jerry Zipkin, who used to always be with Nancy Reagan and still is, and now he switched over, he's with Ivana Trump. We have a lot of them in New York who escort ladies because the husbands just don't want to go to all these boring parties. Husbands have other things to do. They like to have a break from it all. So that's what a walker is, an escort, male escort.
What do the walkers do besides escorting women to parties?
I don't think much. I think they do very little. I think they just charm them, talk to them, tell them how they look. They don't even hold hands.
What I mean is, though, what kind of work do they do?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Is that they're like professional social people?
That's right. They're professional social people. They have good manners. They're usually educated. Well, I can't say some of them don't. Some of them work. One of them in particular is very intelligent. Is a favorite, John Richardson. He's an editor and a writer, and he's doing the big book, three volumes on Picasso. But all the women like him because he's amusing. Basically, these walkers are sometimes much more amusing than their husbands. They have something to talk about. They're interesting. Some of them. I'm not saying all of them.
Did the men who you defined as walkers get very offended by that word?
Oh, no, they like it.
They like it?
Oh, they like it. I went to a lunch for Nancy Reagan on Sunday in the country, and a lot of the guests there were the walkers because they're more amusing than the husbands. They amuse the ladies. They sort of talk like the ladies. They talk on the level of women. They know about what everything's going on. They gossip. They know about money. One of them is a big banker on Wall Street. He handles he's Greek, and he handles Ann Getty's money, and he's a very, very popular walker.
Fashion victims, another expression you came up with?
No, that belongs to the designer by the name of Oscar de la Renta, who was sitting in a restaurant with me one day, and he looked around the room, and he said, "My God, look at these, look what we created," meaning he, the designer, and other designers. "Look how awful the women look in these clothes." What he meant was that the clothes were running away with the women and dominating them, and if they dressed more simply, they'd look much better. After all, fashion is clothes are just nothing like a good meal to be enjoyed. When you look at a woman, you don't look at her clothes right away. You always look at her face, her eyes. It gets to be a boring subject to say, well, so-and-so's wearing Chanel or so-and-so's wearing Valentino.
Any women or men who you think of as being fashion victims?
Oh, all of us at certain times. I remember one day I came back from Tokyo and I had on a raincoat which was supposed to be worn inside out, and I arrived in the office and three people said, "You're a fashion victim yourself." We all are from time to time. Why not? It's fun.
John Fairchild is my guest, the publisher of Women's Wear Daily and W, and the author of the new book, Chic Savages. John Fairchild, one of the things that you've become known for in publishing is the in and out lists. How did you start writing those?
We started writing it because we didn't have anything to write about one day, so we were sitting around the office and we were saying, "Oh, well, that movie is in, everybody's going to see it. Fish is more in than beef because people have stopped eating beef." And we sort of played a game in the office, about six of us. And now we got stuck with this damn list. We have to do it every year and twice a year. And it sells newspapers. That's the truth. It sells newspapers.
Do you ever find them a little absurd yourself, even though you have to put them together?
I find that it's a game. It's like the game of snakes and ladders. It's as you played as a kid. It's like Monopoly. It's just a game because at the end we say the people who made up this list are totally out, meaning they're totally out, wacky, crazy. It's just a game. It's not to be taken seriously. I think our readers now are pretty sophisticated a lot. They're some of them much smarter than we are. Laugh at it.
You know, I have often found that men in the fashion world have have a view of women as being these mysterious creatures with unfathomable tastes and so on. I just want to quote one paragraph from your book. Just, I think it's a mild example of this. You write, "Frankly, I don't believe that sterile fashion will take over. Real women don't want blue Mao jackets and baggy work pants. They want to be different, savagely competitive, to keep ahead and to capture their man. And the creative fashion designers, even though they are almost an endangered species, will survive because women will still want to look great, or at least better than the other woman."
I believe that. I don't take it back. I do believe it. I believe women, that's the challenge is that a woman is basically trying to please a man or be with a man or be with somebody who amuses her, and she wants to look nice. A man wants to look nice too. We feel better when we look great. That's why I say fashion's a noble profession. It's not an art. It's not a sub-art. It's just a craft. But the fact is that designers can make people look attractive is fine. I mean, I think it should be defended. It's a noble profession. And I think women, everybody wants to look nice. So why shouldn't one woman look better than another? Why shouldn't they be competitive in that sense?
You say that a lot of designers are worried about anti-fashion trends, that this is a problem that they have to find a way to cope with. What are some recent anti-fashion trends that have upset the fashion world?
Blue jeans. It's the biggest.
Well, they found a way around that. Designer
yeah,
jeans.
they found it. Somebody put diamond studs or diamonds up the side of blue jeans, and that made blue jeans high fashion. I think the whole challenge of sportswear, the outdoor sporty look. But then the clever designers like Armani got around that. They brought those outdoor clothes, that California laid-back look into their own clothes, so they overcame it. But that's sort of an anti-fashion trend.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've done is take anti-fashion trends and made them fashionable. Clever designers.
Mm-hmm. Whenever I talk to someone whose business is fashion or related to fashion, I'd like to know how they dress. How do you typically dress for work every day?
Oh, I typically dress in a gray flannel suit, a nice one, I hope. I love my neckties, and just a blue shirt, a blue and white striped shirt. That's it. Nothing else.
Okay, well, listen, thank you very much for talking with us about fashion and journalism.
Well, thank you for having me.
My guest has been John Fairchild, the publisher of Women's Wear Daily and W. His new book is Chic Savages, The New Rich, The Old Rich, and The World They Inhabit. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, jazz vibraphonist Lionel Hampton. His career spanned 6 decades. When he joined Benny Goodman's band in the 30s, he was one of the first black jazz musicians to play with a white band. His new autobiography, Hamp, has just been published. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet a CEO who doesn't make comparisons between running a competitive business and waging war. Max Dupree is known for having run a successful company with a humanistic leadership style. Coming up, some management advice from the former CEO of Herman Miller. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews L.A. rapper Ice-T's latest album, Freedom of Speech, Just Watch What You Say. It's a response to groups who are trying to suppress what they consider objectionable albums. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Steel Magnolias. Its all-star cast includes Dolly Parton, Shirley MacLaine, Olympia Dukakis, Sally Field, and Daryl Hannah. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Less than 24 hours after a tornado caused death and destruction in Huntsville, Alabama, seven grade school students died during a storm in Newburgh, New York. Officials say that a glass wall blew in on a school cafeteria during a severe thunderstorm, killing the seven children and injuring 18 other people. Ken Barger owns a store across the street from the school.
You know, it looked like a bad storm, and then it just passed, and then when it was over, I walked out, and you could see the school was damaged in the front. Police and fire departments around here were on there 20 seconds after the wind stopped. They were coming down the road, and you could look over there and see the damage and figure something bad had happened.
The storm system was the same one that moved through the South yesterday, spinning off tornadoes that killed 17 people in Huntsville, Alabama. One woman whose home was destroyed by the twister says it's hard to comprehend.
Right now, I don't think it has sunk in, and we're just so thankful that everybody's okay. My son was here by himself, and I had no idea whether he would be here when I got home. So when he was here, that's all that mattered.
In Huntsville, Alabama, about 1,000 people were left homeless by the tornado. According to the Los Angeles Times, the Bush administration has authorized the CIA to launch a new covert operation to oust Panama's General Noriega. NPR's Ann Gerrels reports that while the plan has been submitted to congressional committees, there are still some questions.
Sources confirm the administration would like to recruit Panamanian military officers or exiles to overthrow Noriega and bring him to trial in the United States. Noriega has been indicted on drug trafficking charges in Florida. Officials admit their plan could lead to the death of Noriega. This would be in keeping with the administration's new legal interpretation of the executive order banning covert involvement in assassinations, which basically says the CIA can help coup plotters as long as the death of a political leader is not the goal. Sources indicate Congress has not yet signed off on a new CIA operation and that, quote, some ambiguities must still be worked out, unquote. Congressional approval is not required, but past administrations have heeded congressional reservations. I'm Ann Gerrels in Washington.
In the heaviest fighting of the Battle of San Salvador, government forces attacked rebel positions today as thousands of people fled the city in spite of a curfew. Six priests were tortured and killed at a Roman Catholic school. One church leader said the murders were probably the work of rightist death squads, but a priest at the scene said uniformed soldiers were spotted entering the priest residence before the shooting began. The government and armed forces denied that any troops were involved. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 3 points to close at 2,635.66 on buying some 148 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The new album by L.A. rapper Ice-T is called Freedom of Speech, Watch What You Say. The cover has a sticker on it that cautions parents, X-rated, some material may be extra hype and inappropriate for squares and suckers. One of the songs is titled Shut Up, Be Happy. Rock critic Ken Tucker has his review of Ice-T's latest. From it, here's some of Hit the Deck.
Put the lyrics on the paper with the pen. Even Lee makes the record spin. Islam dropped the beats that you rock to. Thought that I would never get you, got you. Dog on the floor like you know you never done before. How could a brother be so hardcore and still keep you on the floor like a maniac? That's your question? Well, I'ma answer that. I'm on the mic tonight. I'm here to do it right. Ice, the capital T, airtight. Coolest of the cool. I'm back on a mission. Step to me, fool. You're missing. Mine is gone. Pow, you're out of here. This ain't no game to me. This is my career. Throw me a mic.
plug it in.
Bet.
I won't be happy till the dance floor's wet. I ain't no rookie, I'm a microphone vet. Evil Lee's on the set. Hit the deck.
Many people were upset last week by the way the National Endowment for the Arts withdrew its funding for a New York art exhibit about AIDS. I hope you realize that there are similar incursions on artistic freedom here in the world of popular music. This, in fact, is what most of Ice-T's new album is all about, the slow, steady suppression of rap music that has a political edge.
Freedom of speech!
Yeah, just watch what you say.
Freedom of speech!
Yeah, you better watch what you say.
Freedom of speech!
Just watch what you say.
Parental advisory. Parental advisory.
Freedom of speech, let them take it from me, next they'll take it from you, then what you gonna do? Let them censor books, let them censor art, PMRC, this is where the witch hunt starts. You'll censor what we see, we read, we hear, we learn, the books will burn. You better think it out, we should be able to say anything. Our lungs were meant to shout, say what we feel, yell out what's real, even though it may not bring mass appeal. Your opinion is yours, my opinion is mine, if you don't like what I'm saying, fine. But don't close it, always keep an open mind, a man who fails to listen is blind. We only got one right left in the world today, let me have it or throw the Constitution away.
Freedom of speech!
Ice-T directs his anger at the Parents Music Resource Center, which recently released its latest list of so-called objectionable albums that this Washington-based committee thinks should have warning labels. Given all of rock and roll to complain about, every one of the albums on the PMRC's list was by a black artist. Is it any wonder that Ice-T feels his right to be as political and as profane as he wants is in danger?
I'm sweating heavy because my face is on TV. Everybody in this whole world's after me. Since I was young, I never had a damn thing. At Christmas time, I'd hate to hear the bells ring. Because in the ghetto, Santa ain't got a dime. Your mother's standing in the welfare line. The way that you survive is crime. My life is over, so I might as well speak my mind. I killed a brother because the system had me geared to kill. Because what I call home, you call hell. My ghetto quarters ain't no better than a jail cell. But there's a message in this story that I'm trying to tell. We're just brothers on the streets killing brothers. The system has geared to kill one another. Selling dope to poison each other. The plan of the man, word to the mother. But I'm a sucker because I fell into their plan. 187, I killed a brother, man. My life on earth with hell, you understand. But when I die, I'm going to hell again. I'm the hunted child.
Until a few years ago, LA's impact on rap music was minimal. Rap was being made most forcefully in East Coast cities, in New York, Philadelphia, Washington, Detroit. Some of this had to do with the fact that the LA music industry isn't geared to react to black street music. The city of laid-back folk and rock careerism wasn't going out of its way to sign up local rap acts, which in any case were slow to form. The simplest and most logical reason for this, I've always thought, is that Los Angeles is a car culture. Neighborhoods are spread out over wide areas, and you get around on wheels, not on foot. And rap, like the doo-wop that preceded it 20 years before, is the product of street corner culture. In any case, Ice-T here expresses his annoyance with the conservatism of Los Angeles radio stations and other factors that kept L.A. rap from blossoming before now.
Dig it. I'm just a brother from L.A., South Central. I live like the flyway. Used to bang and hustle, but I traded for the big game. Infamy got dumped for fame. Now I'm known and respected as creator of the crime rhyme. But my lyrics are deeper, because I'm the one that makes you think before you make a move. I wrote Pusha, High Rollers, and Colors just to prove that I can kick game and drop knowledge at the same time. But one L.A. station wouldn't play my records one time. I'm trying to save my community, but these bourgeois blacks keep on dogging me. They don't care about violence, drugs, and gangs. KGLH, you ain't about nothing. You're just a bunch of punk bourgeois black suckers, and this one's for me. You won't play no Public Enemy. You ain't playing no Boogie Down Productions. You ain't trying to represent the black community. You just caring about your little old R&B bull you play all day and night. I represent Los Angeles all over the United States, and you ain't did nothing for me. Think about it.
Ice-T took his name from Iceberg Slim, the black pulp novelist whose 60s thrillers were informed by that decade's spirit of activism and radicalism. Iceberg Slim's novels were steeped in violence and a sophisticated articulation of ghetto poverty as state oppression. They find their parallel in Ice-T's rap music. Like a good novelist himself, Ice-T is capable of setting a scene and describing action in quick, vivid terms. On a song such as Peel Their Caps Back, he turns into an action filmmaker, summoning up images that might have come from a thriller directed by Walter Hill or Sam Peckinpah. It's the sort of rude eloquence that makes Ice-T a valuable artist.
12 o'clock midnight, posse was airtight, 25 cars under the streetlights. Some people talk while others cry. Ink was a brother who shouldn't have died. Then the silence broke. Ice, what's it gonna be?
38 hard brothers stood and stared at me. There were only two words that I had to say. P-A-Y-B-A-C-K. The car's loaded with a silence that could wake the dead. Pistols clicked as the chamber's loaded full of lead. Everyone in the crew knew what I said. It would mean by morning somebody else would soon be dead.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for The Village Voice, LA Weekly, and Spin. This is Fresh Air. In 1988, a Fortune magazine poll of executives and analysts picked Herman Miller as one of the 10 most admired companies in the country. The company has been manufacturing well-designed furniture since 1923, when it was founded by D.J. Dupree. The company's best-known designers included George Nelson and Charles Eames. Its best-known product is the 1956 Eames chair. D.J. Dupree's son, Max, took over the leadership of the company in 1980 and ran it till last year. As CEO, Max managed through respect, not intimidation. He viewed the company as a community built on relationships among employees. Max Dupree describes his management style in his new book, Leadership is an Art. He tells a story about his father's early days at the company, which set the tone for its future management.
That's the story of the millwright, who in those days, in the 20s, was a crucial figure in a small manufacturing company, because that was before the days of electric motors. And so a machine room, which for instance ran saws, drill presses, that kind of thing, all kinds of equipment, was all run by a pulley system, so that every machine was run by a pulley from the main drive, and the main drive was run by the steam engine. And the steam engine was driven by the waste, burning the waste from the operation. So it was a beautiful cycle. And the person who had to make sure all of that worked was the millwright. So he was indispensable. He came before everybody did, made sure the factory was ready to run, and then stayed till after everybody left. And that was his job. And one day, he died. And my father was still a relatively young manager at the time. Didn't quite know what to do about such a situation, but decided that he should go call on the family. And he did, and he met in the living room with the widow and the children, and during the course of the visit, the widow asked if it would be okay if she read some poetry. And of course my father said, sure. So she went to another room and came out with a bound book and sat and read for several minutes from this book, and it was beautiful poetry. And when she finished, my father said, that's really beautiful. Who wrote that? And she said, my husband did. Well, as he was walking home from that visit, he began to struggle with a question that we really struggle with even today, which is, did we have a millwright who wrote poetry, or did we have a poet who did millwright work?
What difference did it make to you one way or another?
The difference that it made to me as I was growing up as a manager is that it explained to me in a graphic way that there's a lot more to every person we come across than is instantly visible. And that we had to understand that the people that we work with are usually deeper and have more potential than what a given job may require. Another thing that it taught me is that there's a breadth to our diversity that's very important. And if as a leader you decide that you're going to put an emphasis on reaching potential, as for instance compared to reaching goals, then you need that understanding of the uncommonness of persons.
There are 5,000 people in your company. How can you keep a sense of everybody's personal, individual nature when you're dealing with a company of that size?
Well, you work at it in two ways. One is that I think as a leader, you make a conscious decision that you're going to put an emphasis in your own life and work on relationships as compared to agendas. And the other is you try to discover ways in which you can actually be in touch in a meaningful way with as many people as possible. Can I give you an example?
Sure.
One of the things that you hear occasionally in so-called business literature is that there's such a thing as management by walking around. To me, that's only a partial answer. What we did when I was the CEO is it was required of the six people on my work team that once a month, each of us had a brown bag luncheon with at least 12 people in the company, and we could not pick the agenda. In other words, we always had to deal with agenda that was brought to the table by the employees, and the meeting had to go on for at least an hour. Well, you see, as compared, for instance, to managing by walking around, this gives people an opportunity to not only enter into a discussion with you, but to examine the discussion, which is what you have to do if you're going to have meaningful relationships.
Now, who would those 12 people be who would meet with you? Because I've noticed that a lot of corporations are very uncomfortable about people from the bottom part of the pyramid talking directly to the people at the top part of the pyramid.
Yeah, that's true. There are a lot of people in organizations who are very insecure about that. But, you see, it improves the quality of communication throughout the organization if all so-called levels are interacting together. If a middle manager knows that at some point some of her employees are going to be talking to the CEO, then she's going to be much sharper about the way in which she communicates with her group. There are some risks in that, but the advantages far outweigh the risks. And the way we did it is we allowed people to volunteer for these meetings. Nobody had to come to the meetings.
Mm-hmm. You have to make it really clear that you're not going to hold anything against someone if they say something negative to you or about you.
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Was that ever hard for you to do?
If someone
has the guts to tell you something that they think is really wrong, either with your management style or with the company?
Yeah, sometimes it's difficult. I had an experience, which was a good experience for me, quite a few years ago when I was doing that. A young woman in the group turned to me and said, why don't you approve of babies by adoption? And I said, well, I do. She said, no, you don't. I said, well, I do. She said, you do not. And I said, well, you know, tell me more. She said, if you really approved of having babies by adoption, you would have a fringe benefit for it. But this company only pays for natural babies. And I didn't know that. And so later we got two or three of us together and talked with her further about it. And it took us about 2 weeks to change the policy so that adopted babies were also paid for by the company benefit program.
What's an example of a time when you were faced with perhaps an economic crisis where you had to do something you really didn't want to do, such as laying off workers? I don't know if that's happened to you, but if it has, I'm sure it was difficult to figure out how to do it, how to handle it.
Yeah, it happens, I think, in most companies on a kind of a cyclical basis. You do reach these points where you need to flatten management, as they say these days, or where you're overstaffed and you've been too optimistic in adding people, or orders fall off. And so you do have to have some layoffs from time to time. I think that one of the techniques that we developed for dealing with it, probably the best technique, and we don't always use it, but we use it most of the time, is we communicate with people about what's happening, and then we invite volunteers. And in many parts of the country, there are periods when people are happy to volunteer to be laid off. And we've had many times when people have said, well, you know, our family is in pretty good shape. We can take some time off. We'll let the younger people stay on. Or we've had situations where two spouses work, and one will say, "Okay," in the interest of the whole problem, one of us will take time off for a while. So we found that the fairest and most effective way to handle some of those layoffs has been through volunteering for time off.
And that's with the understanding that there'd be a time when they would be rehired?
Well, usually with the understanding that if rehires become possible, they'd be first on the list.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. So instead of you seeming to arbitrarily make cuts, it becomes more of a cooperative decision in a way.
Yes, that's right. But now I don't want to give you the impression that we always do it so beautifully. We do make some cuts, and sometimes we make cuts in ways that we shouldn't do it, and we feel badly about that afterwards, and I hope we learn from that. Mm-hmm. We do have clay feet.
You've written a book on leadership. Have you ever read one of those management textbooks yourself? A textbook or one of the pop books that have been in such vogue for the past few years?
Well, not for quite a few years. Quite a few years ago, I read especially Peter Drucker's things.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1980, when I became a CEO, Peter has been a consultant to Herman Miller for a good many years, and he and I have become good friends. He said to me, you know, you really ought to stop reading business books. you know how to manage a company, and you don't have much time, and you ought to just read what really appeals to you. So I must say, I haven't read any of those books for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Your book, Leadership is an Art, it's a small book in a time of very thick books. And the print is looks like triple space to me.
Yeah.
Was that your idea, to leave that much space between each line?
Yes, because, you know, leadership is something that we don't know enough about. And I wanted people to be able to contribute to the book. I saw it actually as a participative book. And so, as I mentioned in the introduction, I like people both to read between the lines and write between the lines. Because what I was encouraging them to do was not only to read the book, but to own the book by finishing it. They can, and in fact, one man wrote and told me he had added 5 pages to my book, which I think is terrific.
Max Dupree is now chairman of the board of Herman Miller. His book, Leadership is an Art, is published by Doubleday. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hello, Terry. We are leading the show tonight with the story from El Salvador of the six Jesuit priests who were killed. And we'll have reports from El Salvador. We'll talk to one of the directors of the Society of Jesus, and we'll find out what the United States response will be. We will also be looking to Germany again and to the gains made by the opposition in East Germany. And Noah Adams is still out west. He's in Glacier National Park today in Montana. Noah meets a grizzly bear.
Well, thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new movie Steel Magnolias was adapted from a play of the same name set in a fictional town in Louisiana. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the transformation.
I haven't spent much time in the Deep South, but then I've got the movies to tell me what it's like. It's tacky, for one thing. People down there have hilariously bad taste in everything. The women sit around in curlers talking about recipes and men. The men do a lot of shooting and cussing and complaining about the womenfolk. Everybody gossips like crazy, and everybody speaks in these earthy, incredibly convoluted barnyard metaphors. Values down there seem petty and shallow until someone's in trouble. That's when everybody pulls together because they're such good folks at heart. And in the end, you know, you just feel like crying. The latest installment in Hollywood's Song of the South is Steel Magnolias, which began life as a hit off-Broadway play cleverly set in a beauty parlor. The film's director, Herbert Ross, has opened the thing up, whereupon all the beauty and most of the cleverness leaked out. Part of the problem is that writer Robert Harling's lines are theater lines, not movie lines. Amid the contrivances of the stage, they may sound reasonably convincing, but with the detritus of real life placed all around them, they sound made up and strained, especially since the all-star cast is sometimes more starry than skilled. Just listen to Dolly Parton as the beauty salon owner, tutoring her new employee, played by Daryl Hannah.
I am so excited. I can't believe it's happening. I'm a beautician.
Glamour technician.
Glamour technician.
And I'll have you know you are working in the most successful shop in this town. Because I have a strict philosophy that I have stuck to for 15 years. There is no such thing as natural beauty.
There is no such thing as natural beauty.
You remember that, or we're all out of a job.
Steel Magnolias weaves its tidy string of Deep South cliches around the rituals of everyday life. First, there's the wedding of a belle played by Julia Roberts. Then there's the announcement of her pregnancy, which upsets her mother, played by Sally Field, because the girl's a diabetic who may not survive childbearing. And then, well, I almost don't have to tell you more except to say that Steel Magnolias turns out to be a terms of endearment with brain damage. And the last half hour or so is one strenuous, all-out tearjerk. It's the kind of tearjerk, by the way, that makes you feel as though you were weeping because someone had just knocked your teeth out. Ross's direction is so inelegant that the stars seem to be stepping to stage center one by one and belting their punchlines out at you. After a while, you feel like dodging, and the movie loses whatever hope it may have had of a rolling comic rhythm. Along with Parton and Hannah, Olympia Dukakis also seems woefully out of place, although Shirley MacLaine disports herself with her usual professional gloss as the neighborhood curmudgeon. And as for Sally Field, all right, we like her, we like her. Now, if only just once we could see a movie about the South in which the characters aspired to something more intriguing than symmetrical hairdos and flashy cars and great seats at the football game.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Thad Kirk, Ron Barron, and Orji Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Lionel Hampton, the musician who introduced the vibraphone to jazz. Also, Caetano Veloso, the popular Brazilian singer-songwriter, tells us why he was imprisoned for his music. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.